ask you a little bit? You were the CEO of the Native Association for quite a long time, and I think you helped get that started, right?
With what?
The Seldovia Native Association. Can you talk a little bit about getting that up and running?
During the fight for the Claims Act, which wasn't very easy, but I attended a lot of meetings. I was on the Rural Cap board, and we used to, the Rural Cap area was Seldovia, Nanalchik, Port Graham, English Bay, and Kodiak, all of Kodiak Island. And so we got involved in the claims fight, and we our basic thing was we all agreed that we needed some kind of a settlement. We didn't really know what. One of the things people talked about was, as I recall, we talked about the native people getting the land. But our thinking at that time was each native would get land. It wasn't like the way it turned out. Then there was also those people that wanted land that they could sell so they could access money. There was all kinds of versions. Every time we talked about it, we would pass resolutions. I mean, every meeting we ever had, we'd pass resolutions on the land claims. I don't know that they ever went any place that ever did any, but one thing we were united in that we needed some kind of a settlement. We all agreed that what Russia sold to America was not the state of Alaska or the territory. They sold the Russian settlements. It was Kenai, Sitka, Juneau, Kodiak. There's four places. And that is in the treaty. So then what about the rest of Alaska? Well, then also the United States said the natives in Alaska could be citizens, but only the civilized tribes. Well, whoever said we were civilized or not? See, that raises a question on our citizenship. Nobody ever declared me civilized. And I don't know who would or wouldn't. Well, I know who wouldn't, but anyway, so when the settlement was finally arrived at, we'd sent money, we'd donate out of our pocket for people to go into Washington, D.C. and stuff, but we couldn't afford anybody from our area to go. So we didn't have any representation. Finally, Kodiak did get some people to go, but we finally got the settlement. Well, then, when we got the settlement, we didn't know what it meant, but they wanted us to organize, and one day we had a meeting, and we had a very well-attended meeting on the, if I remember right, it was an old BIA schoolhouse. And a lady member from here who lived in Anchorage, she brought an attorney. And they explained to us we needed to incorporate. And in turn, the deal was the region, there would be 12 regions and the 13th region out of state, and then all the villages. And our, at that time, Solovia was in the Chugach region. And we said, no, we didn't like that. We wanted to be in Cook Inlet. We're not in Chugach, that's Prince William Sound and so forth. But Port Graham and Nanwalek, English Bay, they wanted to be in Chugach. So eventually we got the boundary changed so that we're in Cook Inlet and they're in Chugach. But then we had to incorporate, and so this lady, she said, well, I will be the president and I can run the corporation from my home in Anchorage, because the state offices and the federal offices are all in Anchorage. So I stood up and I said, no. I said, this is Soldovia's Native Association, and it should be in Soldovia. And we live in Soldovia, should be running our own corporation. Well, then right away, a lady sitting on the other side of my wife at the time, she says, well, Freddie, why don't you do it then? I was fishing at a crab boat. I was happy as could be. And like an idiot, I said, oh, damn it, I will, because I just didn't want it to be taken away into Anchorage. So with that, that's how I got to be president. And well, then we had to have incorporators, and we actually had to ask people to volunteer, you know, because nobody really, we've been so close so many times to being organized through the years and native claims, and then it's always taken away, and so we did the incorporation. And the attorney took the paperwork and filed it. And I believe it was February when we got our certificate. So that was in 90 or 71. And then in 72 was the year we got the paper finalized. Well, then we found out that the regions had 5 years control of the finances for each village. And the Anchorage people, they decided that they would send us some office equipment. And they sent us a desk and a chair and an inbox, you know, like you see on the in and out for mail. And this inbox was two pieces of wood with four pieces of brass, and they wanted $55 to charge to our account for that. And I said, we got no need for it. So I got the board agreed, and we voted to send it back. And from that point on, we had animosity between us and the region. Because they thought they knew what was best for us, and we said no. So the first 5 years were very difficult. I was the president. We had basically had to ask people to serve on our board of directors. And just the region wasn't helping us on anything. They wanted to tell us what land to take, and the way the Claims Act is, the village owns the land, but the region owns the subsurface of that land. So they wanted to do a mineral search to make sure we selected mineral lands. And we said, no, this is our homeland. We'll do our own selections. And we can't do nothing about them owning the subsurface, but they'll get it. So we did that, and then, of course, our first selection is this township that the city of Solovia is on. It includes the subdivision area. Then the state fought us and filed a lawsuit against us because they didn't want us to get that land. They said the state had selected it, which state selected land was available to us. They said, but that land was encumbered because they were going to give it to the Kenai Borough. The borough is entitled to 10% of the state land within the borough boundaries. And the borough said yes. Well, they never had done any paperwork or nothing on it, but we went to court. I told the shareholders, I still believe that the shareholders should have the land. I said, the government's taking all this native land, putting it in the corporations, and you're going to get a piece of paper, 8x11, that says you own stock, but you don't own the land. Now, this is your land, but you don't get it. You get the piece of paper. So I said, let's subdivide the land and deed it to the shareholders. My idea was to subdivide all the land, but we couldn't afford to subdivide all the land. We didn't have no money. But I said, well, let's start out here. And my idea was to give 5 acres to every shareholder. Well, we got a firm that agreed to survey it, and we'll pay them when we get the money. And so when they got to looking at the land and everything, they came to me and said, we can't get 5 acres for 250 shareholders out there. By the time you take the roads and out and so forth, we can do 3 acres. So we took a vote on that, and we agreed to 3 acres. And so we went ahead with the subdivision. Well, they were surveying it while we were still fighting in court. The state wanted to file an injunction against us, saying we can't do that, that we're trespassing. But the attorneys agreed that we were not trespassing because the land was state selected and that was available to us. So it took 7 years. We had the land surveyed, we had the road right-of-ways put in. We put in 100-foot right-of-ways for every road instead of the 60-foot that the state wanted on the Jackloff Road. We put 100 feet. And it was all staked. The surveyors put in the brass, or the survey markers with a locator stake on each one. And we still didn't own the land. But finally we won. And in June month, we had a meeting, and we used the city hall, and we had a large map, and we had all the shareholders' numbers, share numbers, and we had the lot numbers. And we drew a share number and a lot number, and that's how people got the subdivision. And Crystal's daughter and my daughter, no, Crystal and my daughter, yeah, she didn't have any kids then. They were the recorders. They wrote on the map who got what. And it was an interesting day, nice, warm, sunny day. People would find out that they got the lot. Darlene was my secretary, and she made a map of each lot as well as a map of the big lot subdivision showing where the lots were. There was no roads out there then, just a Jackloff Road. But people would take off and go locate their land. They were stumbling around the woods. Most people didn't know how to locate the land, but it was an interesting day. And we did that, and the first guy to build bought a lot and down near the bluff, and he walked down, he located the lot, he bought it from a sheriff. That was the other thing we did. We deeded this land fee simple to the shareholders because we wanted them to be able to, the elderly shareholders, we told, here's your chance, sell the land and access the money. Because your kids have land, they're gonna have their own lots, and most people did. But after Surrey, the regional corporation saw what we did, they got other regions and they went to people and they went to Washington, D.C. and had the act amended to where now you can't do that. You can't deed the land to the shareholders. You can deed land with what's called a life estate and you own it, but when you die, it goes back to the corporation. You can will it to your kids, but only if the corporation agrees, and you have to die to find. So you really don't know if your kids are going to get the land or not, because you have to die first. And so that stopped our great plan of getting the land all to the shareholders. But it did a great thing. It you know, a lot of people lived in town and rental places and trailers and whatnot. Now they got land and they don't have their neighbors looking in their windows and stuff. And I was on the city council also at the time, and I remember the mayor was complaining about, I'm taking his citizens away, and there's not going to be anybody left in town. Well, regardless of whether people are in town or not, you still got the tax base, the land, you know, and I don't see any vacant lots available in town. So it brought more people in. Now we wound up with a tremendous amount of absentee ownership, which is fine. But we also had local people that needed land to build on, and so the subdivision has evolved and keeps growing and growing, and eventually, you know, we'll need sewer and water out there, and we had that plan, which will take many years to develop, but the city, of course, let me know right away that I could not expect the city to provide water out there. But I had an engineer friend come and look the area over, and he said if we put a dam in Barbary Creek Canyon, and there's, you know, it's a very narrow canyon, it wouldn't be hard to build a dam there. There's a system where water going over the dam comes from some kind of a jet pump that would pump water up. It seems that for every 2 gallons going over, you get like a half a gallon up. And we could put a tank up on the hill and fill the tank, and it would feed the whole subdivision. As a matter of fact, the city was running out of water from the fish plants. We had a terrible water shortage here. We could supply water to the city. Barbary Creek Valley's got a lot of water. And the sewer system was, we could do it in about four systems. And so in the future, that'll all happen. But it takes growth and time to, and of course, a lot of money. So all these things were happening. But at the same time, we were short of funds. And the state had us tied up in court over this core township. We couldn't do nothing. So I was talking to a land planner lady in Anchorage one day. We were having lunch together, actually. And she said, you know, your problem is the state is going to break you, and the region is not going to help you. And you guys are going to go bankrupt. And she said, what you need to do is change your priorities. Our core township was our number one priority, filed at the BLM. She said, you need to find some timberland. Timber in Alaska in them days was very high and very active and so forth, and sell timber. And then you can stand on your own 2 feet. So we did. We passed the resolutions and we made this number two priority and made the Solovia Valley Township number one. And the feds had formed what was called a Land Use Planning Commission. And they were to review all the native selections for whatever purpose. John Kohlberg was our vice president, I believe, but he and I were in Anchorage at a Surrey meeting. And he said, you know, we ought to go see those land use planning people, see what the hell they're up to. We never hear from them. So we did. We went down and we met a fellow named John Hall, and John, who is the head of it, he's in Washington, D.C., represents a state now. He's going blind now. But anyway, they were so happy. We were the first Native people to ever walk in their door. They'd been in business over a year, and nobody come around. And so we told them about our experiences and why we changed and so forth. And they said, well, we'll get it, and we have 45 days to review it. And if we see problems, we can extend it and so forth. And I said, well, we need it done right away. John Hall said, I don't see a problem with it. He'd looked at the map. He said, I can get this turned out in a few days. Well, the chairman said, we better run the 45 days. He said, but then we don't see a problem. You're okay. So we had to wait the 45 days, but we got it from BLM over to the Land Use Planning Commission, and BLM was upset because we were trying to do one township when we're entitled to three. What about the other two? We said, we'll take care of that later. We got to get one going. And so there was no regulations saying one way or the other. And some of the BLM people said, no, you get all your selections and we'll review the whole thing. But they finally let it go. There was a lady there that was very adamant against us getting it. So we got the thing. I went to Portland, Oregon, and met with a timber survey group. Can't remember their name. Anyway, they did planning and so forth for timber sales, because we had no idea how to sell timber. And they agreed to take it, but they said before they would sell the timber, they wanted us to agree to doing a road survey for the timber roads. In those days, we didn't even have the road to where the landfill is. there was no way to access our land from Soldovia except by water. So that's what we did. We hired this fellow. He was a timber planner, but I forget what the name is. But he lays out the sale of the timber and also the roads. So we had one of our shareholders help him, and I run him back and forth in my skiff. And they spent a week up there laying out the timber sale. But then when he came to me after the first day or so and told me about this block of timber, and I said, no, when you build a road, we want to cut the timber. If you cut the timber on the right side of the road, about 40 acres, we want the left side left alone and move up and stagger it. And he said, why? I said, well, knowing logging people, the logger will come in and cut the wood and he's gone. But we want some trees left for if we harvest ourselves, and we won't have to build a road. Well, he said, you'll never get a logging company to bid on. I said, well, we'll lay it out that way. And he said, okay. Well, that extended the road further up into the valley because we needed more cutting areas. And so then the consultant put the sale up, and we had a couple people come in. One guy came in from Canada, and he said, we don't need your plan. We got our own plan. And I said, well, what's your plan? He said, well, I'll bring a couple barges with equipment and housing for my workers. We'll go up the bay. Where we land, we'll start cutting trees. And when we get all the trees cut, we'll go home. And I said, that's not going to fly with us. So he left, and we had a couple others come and look, and they'd fly around. And I said, I'm not selling no trees unless you look at the wood. Well, they'd fly over the yeah, that's good timber, and so forth. I said, but you haven't seen the trees other than flying over. Well, one guy did hire a boat, and he went up. And then this fellow Robertson came in, and I met with him for a while, and he told me about how he builds roads down in the Tongass Forest and for logging and so forth, and he has a market and everything. I said, but you haven't seen the trees. So he said, how do I get up there? And I said, well, I can run you up the bay. But he said, no. So he went to Homer and hired a helicopter, landed downtown, picked me up, and we flew up in the valley. And he went to three spots and looked at the trees. And I took pictures of him holding a tree so he could say he did see the trees. And he bid, and he bid high, and he got the sale. And he in turn, then he bought the Rocky Phillips homestead to build a road up there. So that's how we got the road up to the native land.
Okay, so we're still talking with Fred.
Okay. Well, you know, we managed to get a logging contract, and he did a very good job. He developed the land where the rock quarry is now as the staging site for the logs. And he was a very good logger. One of the things we noticed right away was there was a lot of timber that wouldn't make the market. Some had stump rot, some was too short, pieces. Some was windblown tops and whatnot. And so I talked to the contractor and I said, while you're yarding out the logs, why don't you bring those and dump them along the road? People are burning a lot of wood, but they don't have access to wood. This would make a great, great thing for the local people. And he agreed, and he did a wonderful job. We didn't allow any wood cutting when the logging was on. But after they finished, people could go out there and cut wood and so forth. And we issued a permit for $10, 30 days, and you could cut as much wood as you wanted in 30 days. An interesting thing, we had two woodcutter guys. They had jobs in town, and they wanted to know if they couldn't use their 30 days, just or 2 days on each weekend. And I said, no, I said, that wasn't fair to the other people. I mean, for $10, you could buy another permit, you know. But anyway, so we got the logging going, and we started making money, good money, and we started paying dividends. In the 25 years that I was CEO, we paid $16 million in dividends to the shareholders. So with the land, 3 acres of land per shareholder plus the $16 million, we had a very good run. It was very good. One of the interesting things was the state filed suit against us in a core township, which tied up that land. And we selected the land around Jackaloff Bay and between Jackaloff and Tutka Bay. And the state filed suit again because they claimed it was state selected for mental health purposes. We wound up in court again. The state made the selections, like they said, but we found out later that the state mental health selections were way over. These were over-selections. So the state never got the land under the mental health rule in the end. They did get it, but only because we dropped our claim. And we didn't have the money to fight them in court. But this land planner friend of mine, we were having lunch one day in Anchorage, and she said, why don't you file on the state park, Kachemak Bay State Park? And I said, well, look, that's a park. And she said, no, the state doesn't own the land. They just filed selection on it, and they call it a park. And so I went to the board, and the board agreed. And so we changed our selections then to the state park. That became known, and of course, right away, everybody was up in arms, especially in Homer. People were just really, really mad about the whole idea. And of course, there was a fair amount of people supported our idea, too. They thought it was a waste of time having a state park. Well, we looked at a pretty good struggle there, but I suggested that we trade the land back to the state for other land that had income potential. Didn't have to be in our area, just income land. And the board agreed, and we start looking at other state land. We hired a consultant, and we're digging up state lands. One particular land site we wanted was Granite Point up in Cook Inlet. its potential dock site for the coal mines on the Capps Glacier. There's two companies in California that own that coal up there, but they have to have a way to get it out. Well, they protested. One thing, when the state disposes of land, they have to have public hearings. So every time we selected a parcel and they'd agree, we'd have to have a public hearing. And no matter where it was, people were adamantly against us taking their land away, is basically what they said. And so the dock site was one that I really wanted. I could see the potential. The tide runs equally north and south there, so ships could land at the dock. It's plenty of deep water. And it has a piece of land that we could generate revenue off of. But in the public hearings, were strongly against us, and we never got it. That same happened in Ketchikan. There was a state subdivision down there. I believe it was like 100 and some acres. I believe it was near Saxman's land. But the people there in Ketchikan and the people in Saxman, the Native Corporation, they didn't want us to own it. They wanted the subdivision to be put up for land lease. And I took a look at some of the land. I thought the first thing I would do is log it off. It was some tremendous big trees. And I really thought it would be a great idea, log it off and then sell the lots, sell all the subdivided lots. But that didn't come to pass. We did pick up a few lots along the Sterling Highway at Bing Brown's Landing and Funny River Road and sold out some in Kachemak Bay, a couple small parcels. But we didn't get much. After a long while, there were several governors involved, but some were favorable, some weren't. But the people in Homer were very much in favor of us doing what we were doing. We got a lot of support there. I spoke to the Homer Chamber of Commerce, and they supported us thoroughly. I think I was over there about 3 or 4 meetings for the chamber meetings. And they always wanted to know what we were doing and how we were coming along. And they had good influence with the legislators and so forth. But finally, when Governor Hickel was elected on his second term, he called me one night and he said, "Tell me about this park problem." And this is about 9:30 at night. And so I said, "Well, you know, it seems to be, it's workable, but we're having a lot of problem with your people." And he said, "Well," he said, "it seems to me that it's doable too. Tell me who they are and I'll take care of the problem." And so I did, and he did. And the guy that was my main, I guess you could say, opponent, he was very adamant against us, got transferred right away and to another position, and that helped. And then with Governor Hickel's help, we agreed to do what land we could do, but to cash out the balance. And I said, "Well, now that's going to have to go to the shareholders, and I can't make those kind of decisions." So we had a meeting, and we agreed. And so that's how we saved the park as a park. And we have some holdings yet on the gravel bars on the front of the park that we still own. We own, of course, the Island Peninsula, and we own the north side of Peterson Bay. That's outside the park. And so we have adjacent lands, but then we went through, in selecting the park for trade, you know, when we were trading, the thing was, which land in the park does the state get every time we got a parcel? And they wanted to take the front Chinaput Bay and McCune Flats and so forth. In other words, they would select maybe a third of the land and tell us we could own the mountains. And we said no. I met with DNR a few times, and we finally agreed to we would give up the parkland in an L-shaped pattern starting from the back. In other words, they would get the mountains first. Well, then they wanted an appraisal. Well, prior to that, before the park was established, estate DNR people had done an appraisal, and it was a kind of like from a book or from a map, and they valued the backland mountaintops at $50 an acre, and down to the waterfront, Chinaput and McCune Flats area, I'm trying to think if it was like $300 an acre or something of that sort. And so we agreed that was the best numbers we had. And it was very difficult because we still had these DNR people that insisted they had to have some waterfront all the time. And my answer to that was, well, you know, clear up some of the state land for our selections, and we'll deal with you. You know, of course, right away they offered us the mental health selected land that was so near and dear to their heart a year before. All of a sudden, it was available. We said, no, we don't want it now. So anyway. Thanks to Governor Hickel, he said, let's do it. And he made it happen. The state office in those days was in the Frontier Building in Anchorage. I went up one day, and he said, I will get this through, and you let me know if there's any problems. Just call me directly, and he gave me his home phone number. And so it was interesting. I liked dealing with Governor Hickel because he'd call me in the evening, and he'd call me right here at home, and he'd want to know how things are going and so forth. And he said, I don't want to call you from my office. He says, I have a lot of people that don't think I should be governor and things of that sort. He said, it's better if I call you after I get home. I said, that's fine. I like that. And my wife thought it was okay. And so I tried, when I left the office after work, I tried not to bring it home with me. And, but in his case, I didn't mind. I mean, it was well worth it. When you run a corporation with a variety of shareholders like we had, a lot of shareholders, especially the elder ones, want things to happen right now. And, you know, it's unfortunate, you know, we didn't have title to the land, we didn't have money. All we had was a piece of paper, and some of those shareholders wanted something to happen before they died. And I can understand that, but there wasn't much I could do about it. Just keep trying. And so So we did save the park for the state. We did cash out. We did get some lands. And I think overall, it worked out pretty good. We had some land just east of Homer. I think it was about 135 acres around that small lake that's east of Homer. And it's very soft ground, it's swampland and so forth. But when they built the power house at Bradley Lake and so forth, they built the tunnel from the lake down and they built the powerhouse. And then the feds, under some federal rule, said that they were destroying moose range and they had to make it up. And they had no land available that was good for moose. But we did. And I got the board to agree to let that land go. So the feds bought that land. And if you ever look around there, you'll see there's no development there because that's moose range to replace the land lost for the Bradley Lake Power Project. So I believe we did our share of public service too. But we didn't blow our own horn, so to say, and let the world know about it, because there's always the anti-people. Even in that case, there was people against us using that land for moose range. I don't know what else you could use it for, but because it is all soft ground, and that worked out real well. One of the things while I was president and CEO, I was also president of our tribe, and we had quite a time proving that, you know, we were for real. The natives have been in Saldovia forever, and there's always been natives. We're kind of a unique situation. We have the Athabascan Indians from the north side and down Kachemak Bay. We have the Aleut culture from the Prince William Sound and Kodiak side. And we also have the people from the Iliamna side that would, and Yukon Island was the trading site, and the natives would meet there. So they would do their trading and settle their differences or whatever they had to do at the time. And so we're a mix of natives. We're not just one side. We have a lot of the families here are Eskimos, and there's Aleuts, and there's Indians. And we're far different than the average Alaska village. And it works out pretty good.